The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2016 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2016. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at accsedu.org.
Heavenly Father, we pray for your blessings upon this session and upon all the work that we do here at the ACCS Conference. Lord, we just thank you for the opportunities you set before us and for the conversations that you start here. As we continue to till the soil of this conversation, as we bring back Christian classical education from things that can get lost and kind of mired in our culture today, bless our endeavors. Lift up our hearts, lift up our minds, and lift up our souls to your light, that we may serve you well. We pray all this in Jesus' name. Amen. Folks in the back, I know the mic is a little bit louder today for me. I hope it is for you. Can you all hear me back there? Are we good? Sound check? All right, thank you. All right, so the title today, Hands-on Science in the Grammar School, is going to be multi-tiered. I'm going to put it to you that way. If you're coming looking for things you can do with your kids, you're going to find them. If you're coming looking for bigger frameworks in which to situate things that you want to do with your kids, you're going to find them. The whole point of this is to not only give you some ideas about that, but it's also to make you aware of what you're working with and against in some cases. We're going to spend some time this morning talking about STEM. Now, just a quick survey, so I always like to know my audience on these things. How many of you guys are grammar school teachers right now? Okay. And how many of you are also parents? Okay, me too. Three boys. How many of you are maybe logic and rhetoric school teachers too? You wear several hats. Okay. So what I'm talking about today will actually apply to things that you can do up there as well. This isn't just grammar school. It's a more framework-intensive piece. And how many of you guys are considering or are currently running some sort of STEM-type activity in your school? Okay. How many of you heard of STEM? How many of you know what the acronym means? All right, good. So now that's my pretest. Y'all passed, so we'll figure out where to go from there. First off, a little bit of background on me so you understand who is talking to you today. My name is Chris Hall. I'm the Lower School Academic Dean at the Covenant School in Charlottesville, Virginia. This is my 21st year of teaching. It's my 10th year in administration. I've been a science department chair and science educator for a vast majority of those 21 years. I've taught pre-K, K, 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th, 9th, 12th, and college in my time. Right? It's a long career. Watch me go gray. The topic I'm speaking to you about today is not only near and dear to my classroom, it's also near and dear to me. I kind of practice what I preach in this. What I'm going to talk about, this hands-on grammar school framework and something called the Common Arts, fits with who I am. I'm a farmer. My wife and I decided to homestead a piece of land. We were suburban kids who just wanted to go a little bit deeper. And across the last 11 years, we literally cut out of a piece of woods a working farm. Of course, we've had now three little workers to help us with that one, too. And it was funny because Matt was asking us this morning, who do you recognize in that play? Who is you? And I'm like, I'm the barefoot kid. I know about chopping wood and getting milk and all those other things. And those are kind of my kids, too. It's a fun one to think about. I'm a woodworker. I'm a leather worker. I'm a metal worker. I'm a bowyer. I'm an armorer. I make medieval armor. Well, that's a separate conversation if you guys want to talk about that. But I actually brought that to my classroom, which you will see in just a few moments. And I like to think about the work that we do in terms of head, heart, and hands. Right? If I can kind of put those terms in your mind right now, head, heart, and hands, I'm actually borrowing those from Booker T. Washington. Booker T. Washington was a slave for a long time. And as he sought to bring the slaves up in the South after Reconstruction, he rolled forward with this idea of head, heart, and hands to kind of reinvest them in what it means to do work for you and your community, not just for other people as a slave. And a lot of times people, the slaves in that culture said, we don't want to do the work. We want to be the guy who sits on the porch and tells other people to do the work. Okay? And he said, that is not the way to be. And you have to invest yourself in this in kind of a deep way. So understand that I'm drawing from a number of threads to bring you this presentation today. And if any of the things I've just said kind of resonate with you, I encourage you to follow up on them, either through conversation here afterwards or through a lot of really good reading. So first off, let's look at some assumptions, okay? Assumptions about science that I am bringing to this presentation. You ever think about your goals as Christian classical science educators? What does this mean? Okay, the first thing I would think it means is we need to graduate the most technically skilled, competent science students ever. Because God calls us to do so, right? We want to have the most technically capable, knowledgeable, productive scientists leaving our schools, going into those college programs, and bringing Christ into the nature of this ecosystem, because it's very desperately needed. We want to form our kids in a way that allows them to practice their Christian faith in a foreign, potentially hostile culture. When we talk about science today, there was a time when Christian institutions represented the center, the axle of the wheel, if you will, and the rest of the wheel turned upon the foundations that were offered by that Christ center, the church. And now we find ourselves actually on the periphery of the wheel, as other institutions have taken the center place and started to dictate through law and mandate and social convention what happens. We actually find ourselves in the place of educating Daniels. In the exile to Babylon, right, God said to his people, oh, I have plans to prosper you. Right, I'm going to send you into exile, but I have plans to prosper you. And when you go there, when you get taken to Babylon, you're going to have to build houses and plant trees. You're going to be there a while. And if we think about what we need to kind of put in the minds and hearts of our students as they're working through this, we need to think about the Daniel factor. Because they will be serving the kings. Right? They will be the ones who get hired as the research scientists and the engineers and the others in a very economically driven model. And we're going to have them be able to resist the king's food and not bow to the king's idols. Right? So another one to think about is we can't just mirror the way we were taught. We have to think not only outside the box, but outside the FedEx truck here. Okay? We can't borrow wholesale a certain set of practices that has been driven into our university-trained educators and scientists wholesale. Because when we import that, it's like importing weeds into your garden. You're going to be taking in some philosophical elements that will grow and kind of flourish and maybe even choke out the kind of crops that you want to grow. Scientism is one of those, right? The over-application of the scientific method. Build a car using engineering, but don't engineer your relationships. Right? Think about the way that science can be good for certain things, but not for others. And so we've got to not import the weeds with the vegetables, with the fruits, the things that we want. And 3 points that I would say really drive what we're talking about there, what I'm getting at: narrative, telos, and liturgy. Now, without going too deep into these, the narrative is the story you tell. Little kids, especially grammar school kids, need a story. It allows them to understand and tag up on everything that they get along the line, right? And that's why we start with fairy tales. We start with morality plays. We start with Aesop's fables. It allows them to hang what they learn on a certain morality. When I say telos, how many of you know what I mean by that? All right, here's a Greek lesson for those of you. Telos is the end of what you're doing, right? Longer story short, Baron von Steuben in the Revolutionary War shows up at Valley Forge, right? Rides in on his horse. He says, George Washington, I want to train your troops. Washington's at the end of his money. He's at the end of his rope. He's been running. He's fighting a losing war. Sure, Baron von Steuben, come and do it. And the first thing Baron von Steuben does is he changes the commands given for the firing lines. Instead of ready, fire, he says ready, aim, fire. And when you teach science, you got to think about where you're aiming. Don't just pull the trigger. Think about where you're going. And really the telos of science, as we will see, is the logos. It's that order inherent in creation. And every time you're doing science, you're looking right into the face of God. And he's staring back at you from what you're learning. And he's going, I was waiting for you to figure that out. And liturgy. Most of the times we use the word liturgy to talk about a church, right? The liturgy of the church is the hymns you sing and when you bow and when you approach the altar. And it's all those pieces that you embodily do in the service that you're there. You're participating with your body in something that is bigger than your body. It's not only communal and community here, but it's God's mandate to us. This is worship. And so you got to think about the liturgy of your science class. What are the hymns you sing? To what do you bow? When do you approach the altar? There are parallels to these things in the way that you lay out science in your classroom. And we need to think about that just a little bit. And if I've already kind of over-philosophied this for you, don't worry. We're going to back it up. It's early in the morning. All right, so some assumptions. Scientific enterprise, whatever you do with it, has a telos or end. And that end is an encounter with the logos, the principle of divine reason and creative order. That's what we're doing. We're teaching our kids to reason, and like the mirror analogy, right? We're teaching them to reason in a certain way that's reflective of what God wants. And creative order, there's a tremendous amount of providence in creation. And we need to help them see that. It's never just a piece of wood, never just a rock, never just a fish. As soon as you start justing things, they become objects, and you can use them however you want, whether that's ordered or disordered. It's never just something. And we need to start thinking about how we make the kids encounter things in a never just kind of way. What are the dimensions here? Isaac Newton said, Isaac Newton, right, the guy who, if you go to high school, they hold up as an example of the secular scientist. He said, I'm standing upon the seashore throwing stones into a vast ocean of truth. Isaac Newton said this. And what they won't tell you in public high school is Isaac Newton, after he wrote the Principia and the Optics and co-invented calculus, spent the last 30 years of his life doing what? Writing theology. Heretical theology, but it's theology. You just need to, you know, let him work with it. So science is more than just facts and procedures. We have to let that narrative go in there. It's another way we orient ourselves towards God. And there's this thing called natural philosophy that science used to be. The term scientist didn't even get used until the 1880s. It started being used in the news media at the same time that people used the word artist to describe people who participated in the fine arts. Right? The newspapers needed a tag, and so they said scientist, which actually devotes all the energy of what science is, scientia, knowledge, to these people who are technicians. And if we've been training ourselves that way for 140, 150 years almost, right? Just as technicians. We are way more than technicians. And it's time that we recaptured what that means for our kids. We should start in grammar school. If you wait till middle school to feed kids broccoli, they won't like it, especially if they've been eating Cap'n Crunch for the whole time, right? You got to start early and cultivate the taste for certain things from the earliest ages. Let them not only get the taste, but let them get the nutrients that come with that. So, here are some easy bullet points for hands-on science. Before I go any further into this, if you really want to distill hands-on science down, here's two ways to really do it. First is, let them do. Let them do. It's been said that whoever does the talking in a classroom is the one doing the learning. If you're the one doing all the talking and the demoing, you already know this stuff, right? Let them do it. Put it in their hands. Whatever it is, find a way to let them get their hands on it. Bless you. The second format I may offer you is this thing called project work. Okay, how many of you are familiar with project work right now? Okay, only a couple of hands. Project work is like, you know, that's what we use industrial terms for what we write units. Units aren't connected. The refrigerator is a unit. Okay, it's isolated. So it may be on the electrical grid, but it's still a unit. You stack a bunch of refrigerators together, and they still all contain their own food. You're not really getting pollination between, or, you know, you're not going to be making something awesome with the stuff that you find across those. So project work is a way of breaking out of units. In a project work, you have a core of stuff that you want them to encounter. You as the teacher are going to say, yep, by the end of this, we're going to have all these. But then it's kind of free. Project work starts with questions. What do you guys want to know about this? Right? You do something in front of them that's mysterious, and they go, what? And you say, yeah, let's do this, all right? What do you want to know? What do you want to know about what you just saw? What's on your mind now? Where is your head and your heart and your hands soon on this, right? This involves bringing in experts to talk to them. Hey, you guys know you do math, but have you ever met a real mathematician and asked them what they do? Well, I got this professor from the university. He's going to come talk to us about mathematics today. He's not going to throw calculus at you. He's going to just talk about the joy of this. It'll be fun, right? Project work that we do at our school, we do a project in kindergarten where, and I'm actually bringing animals in from my farm. In one of the kindergartens, they hatch eggs. We bring in eggs. They hatch chickens, and they keep the chickens in the room for a month. And so the chickens are growing up. Yeah, that's the first thing that they do immediately, right? That. But that actually brings up, you know, why does it smell? And we talk a little bit about the biology of nitrogen and carbon, right, which they don't know. But, and then they also take that same compost out to the garden. And they realize there's a special place for the chicken compost because in the other kindergarten classroom, we have a bred rabbit. And the rabbit has kits. Rabbits, you may not know this, rabbits always have their babies in the middle of the night. They will come in, the kids come in the next morning, and all of a sudden the box is full of the mom's fur. They pull all the fur off their belly so they can expose the milk and the warmth. And then they mix it in with the straw, and all of a sudden there's this undulating carpet of fur, right? And mom is a little bit on the guard. And so the miracle of birth occurs in our kindergartens. I'd say that's a good place to start, right? Work your way up from there. But this is all project work. It's bigger than just these are the facts that we are going to learn and the objectives that I'm about to meet with you, right? And then we will have some quality control standards at the end of this just to make sure that you're doing okay. No, it's bigger. It's organic. It's alive. Something bigger. So if you really want to just take two takeaways away from what I'm saying today, take these two. Because these things give you axles upon which you can turn instruction in new ways. Now, let's go a little deeper because there's this giant elephant in the education, science education room that we need to address, and that's STEM. Science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. And I'm going to argue today that there are some pros and cons for this. It is not the way people do it today, classical or Christian, right? The imperatives, the narratives around why people do it is not there. And so if we're going to own this, and I do think there's some good reasons we should, we got to rethink what those narratives and those imperatives are. You got to back the argument all the way up to the premises and insert a couple and take a few out to reach a conclusion that is not only good, it's excellent. So for those who don't know, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, STEM. Okay, and if you think about it, for years, when I was taught in school, my science classroom was on the second floor of my middle school. My math classroom was down by the cafeteria. And we always had that class right before lunch, and it smelled like tater tots every day. I still recall this. And all I was thinking about was food. I'm like, yep, I'm here I go. I'm ready to add some food. I'm good. And they were never really talked about. Well, you learned algebra so that you could do, you know, physics or stoichiometry and chemistry. And you learned calculus later so that you could do, you know, more physics. Yeah, but we never had the two teachers in the same room, unless it was the faculty lounge. And you never had them really discussing the integration of the ideas in a deep way between their classes. Well, what makes the math work? Right? A lot of us think of math as a language. It's not. It's a symbolic language, but like poetry, the words you use and the grammar you use don't reflect the things. There's an understanding that's bigger than just the symbols. It's an order that's written into creation. And if someone had told me that at the beginning of physics in high school, I would have been a much better physics student. Oh, okay, now I understand what that means and why it seems to work like this. Whereas opposed to, oh, I got a B plus here and a C minus up there. That's horrible. Right? And occasionally today, just to make the plug, there's an A, right? We've got to pull the arts into this somehow, right? We've got to make this not just technical. We've got to pull the arts in there. The problem is oftentimes it gets pulled in a technical way, right? The narrative that's told about it is not exactly there. So why should we even be addressing this? Why do we need to even talk about STEM? Well, two things. Our parents and students have heard about it. I can't say, as an academic dean, I get many an admissions tour coming through my office or my lab. Do you guys have Legos? Right, I'd say 50, 60%, easy. Do you guys have an engineering program? Yeah, we do. Here, it's my woodworking shop that I got right over here. We'll talk about that in a minute. Right? There's a lot of public debate. Your kids will hear about this sometimes through the news, public debate about jobs in STEM fields. But I think the other reason we should address it isn't the political or the salesmanship of the thing. It's this third one. It can provide you a very strong platform for hands-on learning and deep experience. But only if some fundamental premises are retooled. This is a really good way to get at this hands-on stuff, but you can't go at it the way your secular counterparts are doing because you're missing some pieces that are really important. Just so you understand what this looks like at the Fed level, $2.9 billion on STEM initiatives in last fiscal year alone. That's a stealth bomber plus a couple of others, right? That's a lot of money people are throwing into this thing. They cover all areas from pre-K to grad school. So you got money being funneled to schools for buying things, mostly 3D printers and Legos, and you're getting money funneled to colleges to teach STEM educators. The STEM degree was not an option 10 years ago. 5 years ago, there were a couple of programs. Now it's all over, and you can go and get your master's cert in STEM education if you want. Right? I think there may even be a praxis coming up for this one, if it's not already there. The problem is that we're not quite sure whether the jobs that they have been touting have actually materialized or not. And I went and found a study from the Bureau of Labor Statistics that says, do we have a STEM problem? Yes and yes. Thanks for that. That's very clarifying. They said, well, it depends on how you look at it. We don't have the total number of jobs that were being forecast. In fact, we only have about 15% of the total number of jobs that were being forecast. But we have these really big holes that we really need to fill in certain kinds of things like materials engineering. You may notice that a lot of the new technologies that are coming out are dealing with materials. We're actually manipulating the fundamental atomic structures, micromaterials, and we're saying that that's the thing that we need to be doing right now. So, yeah, there's a STEM shortage there, but overall, it's not kind of the same way we had. And also, this focus on high technology, mostly electronics and computing, Lego robotics and maker spaces, we see a lot of that focus. Now, let's just walk the clock back for a little. Let's go back 200 years for a second, right before the computers are. Who worked with their hands? Who? Farmers, right? Woodworkers? Teamsters? Everybody. Everybody. When I asked my sixth graders this last year, how many of you guys have ever used a screwdriver? 20%. How many of you can tie your shoes? I won't tell you that percentage, but it's equally surprising. We don't do a lot of stuff with hands. We do a lot of stuff with head and with eyes. We look at things. Where do you want to research on? Well, how do you want to know about this? Let's Wikipedia it. Let's go to YouTube. Why don't you put your hands on it? You ever mess with a block of wood? Look at that cool stuff called green. Hey, if you rub it this way, it feels different if you rub it the other way. It's so different from your iPad. So, why this big push? Well, is it Christian and is it classical? Let's take a look at that one for a second. I would say a resounding yes. And also, a resounding no. Aren't you glad you paid for this? You get so many straight answers. So, it depends on how you frame it up, right? If we go strictly for the economic imperative, well, $2.9 billion being thrown at this, and it's really important, and everybody's doing it in the schools, we've got to do it. It's the wrong reason. Don't do it for that reason. And not only that, don't do it for the computing and the Legos, right? If you're going that route, I'm not busting on you, because I think there are some really good things that can happen along that route. I've seen them happen myself. But I think there are some other routes that are not being considered that are more powerful. So some pros and cons, right? Why would I say possible yeses to that? If I say, what is this STEM thing? Is it Christian and classical? Well, consider the trivium and the quadrivium. These are ways of learning, not just bodies of knowledge. And STEM allows you to do that. STEM allows you to pursue, we're not just learning, you know, X facts about chemistry. We're digging into this as a way of learning. Science, technology, engineering, mathematics, we're doing things. We're making things. We're testing things. Prototyping, modifying. These things are bigger than just the knowledge that goes into it. It's process. And if you're looking to take quick notes on this one, look at the stuff that I've italicized, right? Ways of learning. It's one of those ones that gives you a good shot. STEM is interconnected and integrated and could be narratively oriented towards the logos. Right, this manifest order in creation. You can look at materials and consider how they are ordered. I teach a unit on basic chemistry and physics to my sixth graders called Awesome Architecture. It has nothing to do with buildings. It has everything to do with the way God designed thoughtfully the atom. And what are the implications of that? We can't change the position of the protons and the electrons. The whole thing falls apart. It doesn't work. And because it's ordered this way, we get light. Because the electrons can jump up and down, we get different wavelengths and frequencies of light. That's the whole EM spectrum. And because they're that way, the electrons on one repelling on the others, that's why you don't fall through your chair, right? The electrons in your pants are repelling against the electrons in the outer layers of the seat you're sitting in. Isn't that awesome architecture? Wow. Think about what he meant by that, right? This is science. It's not just the facts. STEM is embodied learning, head, heart, and hands. It puts the stuff of your head through your hands via your heart. Where is your heart oriented to this? Notice the virtue formation that's starting to creep in there, right? We have to be prudent. We have to be temperate. We have to be just, demonstrate fortitude. And we do all this with a vision of faith, hope, and love. STEM is enchanting. It captures the imagination and holds it. This guy, Charles Taylor, you're going to hear me talk about in just a moment, is someone that I think you really need to consider. And don't buy his book. Charles Taylor was a philosopher who wrote a 950-page book on the nature of how we've converted our culture from a time a long time ago when God was, he had to be there, to a time when there can't be a God. Right? Think about the nature of the switch across the last 400 years. Well, the first thing that he says about it is we had to disenchant things. It's just matter. Then we can use it however we want. That's just a person. We can modify it however we want. The other one he says on that is the filtered self. Who has a cell phone? Social media. It could be virtue forming in terms of craft, right? These are the yeses. This is how we could say that STEM can be Christian and classical. Very much so. Very much so. But not if we do it the way the rest of our society is doing it right now. Here are some no's. An over-focus on electronic technology. Not manual technology, electronics. If you're going to use STEM, you've got to be using computers, you've got to be using 3D printers, you've got to have all this stuff you plug in. Heaven help you if you got a sub on a day when there's no power. Right? You ever thought of the ephemeralness of flowing electrons? Click, lights out. Have a library. And also the economic imperative. This is the idol in the mirror. Okay? I go to so many schools, independent and public schools, who say our STEM program is based on entrepreneurial enterprise. We want our kids to become entrepreneurs in certain fields. So in other words, you're telling them that the whole reason that you are doing this is so you can make money. Okay. How much more are they going to understand the materials and the poetry of the facts you're placing in front of them if you're telling them that? The reason that you do STEM is because what you make makes you. So, what we need is a solution that addresses the no's, bolsters the yeses, bless you, would have to be able to work in our setting, whatever your setting is, right? I teach in the basement of a church, I have a giant mega campus, whatever it is, it's got to be able to work there. It'd have to happen without a tremendous amount of investment up front. We're educators, and it would have to be something that teachers could start doing without a lot of additional professional development. Well, as an administrator, I look at that and go, sure, I'm there. No problem. We can do that in August. So, yeah, what do we do? Right. So we got to reframe. Here's where I go big picture on you. Before I gave you a couple of bullets, put their hands on it, right? Let them do project work. Well, let me take you back to the medieval times and give you what they would have told you. Hugh of St. Victor wrote this awesome book called The Didascalicon, and it sounds by that title totally inaccessible, right, unless you're a Latin scholar. But I'm here to tell you this is one of the most accessible books on good education you could ever get. The Didascalicon, D-I-D-A-S, Calicon, C-A-L-I-C-O-N. It was written in the 1150s. So not mod. Right? But in this book, Hugh of St. Victor outlines what you see there in the left column. Right? Tailoring and weaving, agriculture, medicine, warfare and hunting. He actually calls that armaments. Trade, navigation, and theatrics. And he says, these are the complements of the trivium and quadrivium. These are the complements of the trivium and quadrivium, because these are the things that allow you to take the knowledge you've gained through the trivium and quadrivium and put them into actual practice in ways that will keep you alive. Which of those do we not outsource today? Do you make your own clothes? Do you make your own food? How about your own medicine? Do you defend yourself? How are you with trade? Okay, navigating. If I take you outside, can you find north, south, east, and west just by looking at the sun? Theatrics, well, we're all trained in that. We're educators. Right? That's what we do. John Scotus Arianna came back a little bit later, and he added these to the list. He's flipped a few out. He said architecture, the art of building, right? Building things, big and small. Cooking, taking those ingredients that you find and turning them into a harmonious whole. And blacksmithing and metallurgy, the working of a particular material. Now, understand that the common arts is not an exclusive list. If you look at this, it's the frame of the picture that actually counts more than the things that appear within that little box. Because woodworking is a common art. Leatherworking is a common art. Right? These are things that require the skill of the hand via the head and the heart. And they're the very things that allow people to survive. You can't have a culture if you don't have a house and clothes and food and can defend yourself, and et cetera, et cetera. I think you see the point. It's interesting to note the history of this. The ancient Greeks totally busted on the common arts. Plato has Socrates in one of the dialogues that's escaping me right now saying, well, you know, these are the arts of slaves. We really don't need to be messing with that. I think it was in the Republic, actually. We don't need to be messing with these. And yet it's funny because he's sitting on a stool made by a woodworker wearing clothes made by someone who can weave, eating food and drinking wine in a building that, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Right? Ponder that. These are the basics, the fundamentals. And think of what they mean for hands-on science instruction. Any of these becomes a vector to chemistry, biology, physics, earth science. All you got to do is see how one of these fits into whatever you're doing. And here's where you even get beyond science. You want to do some hands-on history? Grow some crops that the settlers in your area had to grow. And do it right on your campus. You're going to get all the benefits of doing those arts, and you can talk, well, the settlers had to overcome a certain biological limitation. What do you mean by that? Here's what I mean. Think about language arts. I know my kids in sixth grade read The Bronze Bow. Any of you guys out there do that? Okay, so The Bronze Bow. We had an awesome discussion about metallurgy because the guy goes back to the camp and they're hammering out their swords up there, you know, camp of rebels up in the... How do they do that? Where do they even find the food or the, you know, the food for their fire, essentially, their wood and their coal and their other things? Well, let's talk about blacksmithing. In fact, hey, why don't we do some for a little bit? And for one day, I took off this jacket, and I actually hammered out some swords in the science lab because you can do that if you have bar stock and a blowtorch and hammers. And all of a sudden, it was real. And we talked about the difference between solids and liquids in the process because in order to hammer something out, you got to make it a little bit liquid. You can't hammer a solid real well. So how do you do that? Well, you raise the molecular kinetic energy. You make the molecules go faster, and then you can move them just by hitting them with a hammer. So think about the common arts as a template within which you can make anything hands-on. So John Milton, this is one of my favorite quotes with John Milton. He could not have thrown me a better letter through history. Milton was writing this letter of education to one of his friends. And John Milton, Paradise Lost, great, you know, master poet. You'll hear more about him this afternoon. And having passed the principles of arithmetic, geometry, astronomy, and geography, with a general compact of physics, they, he's talking about the students in this school that he's designing through this letter, may descend in mathematics to the instrumental science of trigonometry, and from thence to where? Fortification, architecture, engineering, which means the building of siege weapons, and navigation. To set forward all these proceedings in nature and mathematics, what hinders but that they may procure as oft shall be needful the helpful experiences of dirty people? Hunters, fowlers, fishermen, shepherds, gardeners, apothecaries, wear your jeans some days, right? Get your hands dirty. And better yet, let them get theirs dirty. Because what Milton is talking about here is how you take the trivium and quadrivium and put them into things that allow people to really understand our human nature. We are not in the garden anymore. We've been cast out. We are to work by the sweat of our brows. This is how we do it. And in the same process, turn that right back to God. Okay, you told us to do this. I'm going to sweat for you, and I'm going to make the best darn X, whatever it is, for you. Right? I'm going to be a craftsman. In the process, I'm going to learn some cool stuff about science, but I'm also getting this. Right? So, let me show you now that I kind of got you on this, let me show you what happens when these are broken. Let me show you a piece about how this turned. And I'm going to borrow from another presentation I did at the Alcuin Fellowship for SCL last year. Taylor, Taylor, and Taylor, a morality play in many, many acts. Right? And just for a moment, walk with me down the story of this. And again, this is the story of what happens when we have kind of this modern view of doing these common arts. Right? I'm not advocating for that at all. First off, Frederick Winslow Taylor. Anybody know who this is? Frederick Winslow Taylor was the founder of scientific management. In the 1870s and 80s, he figured out the scientific method was totally the way to go, and what we need to do is apply that method to just about everything, including the management of human beings in factories, because we need to make our industry as tight as we can. We don't want to squeeze pennies. What we want to do is make sure that we get everything so tuned that this goes really well, right? Profitability will soar. In fact, you know who one of his favorite advocates was? Henry Ford. This is the Ford assembly line, circa 1910, I believe it was. Okay, so Ford took on the principles of scientific management. He had Taylor come into his factories and give him all that he could about how to do this. Productivity soared. In 1900, 7,632 wagon and carriage makers in the U.S., down to the big three within a few years. Because he adopted the principles of scientific management, his operation was so darn efficient, it was utterly profitable, everybody else went down. Everybody. And so did the workers. So great was labor's distaste for this new machine system that toward the close of 1913, every time the company wanted to add 100 men to its factory personnel, it was necessary to hire 963. You want to keep 100 guys in the line? 863 are going to slough off. And in fact, it was so bad, Ford doubled his daily wage for his workers to keep that line staffed. Why? Why would this happen? Let's yeah. Here's some wheelwrights at Colonial Williamsburg. You see that thing he's working on? It's made of wood, right? Spokes of a wheel. He's got a wagon wheel up there. He's got it clamped in a jig, and he's just working his way down. Okay. What's the problem with working with wood? Are any of those spokes the same? No. There are knots in that wood. Wood has grain. Jesus knew this. He was apprenticed to a carpenter, right? I think that was good formation. Every one of those folks is different. And so if you're a wheelwright, you got to know what you're doing. You got to pay careful attention to your material. You are a skilled laborer, man. You know what you're doing. So along comes Ford and says, you're going to put bolt Q into slot T, and you're going to do it over and over and over again, and your buddy next to you is going to do the same thing with the next bolt down the line. How are you going to feel? Pretty darn insulted. In fact, out of 963 of you, 863 of you are so insulted, you're not even willing to take a double pay to stick around. You're out. You're going to go do something else. This is when this is a time when we were making a transition, right? The local craftsmen, the people with the skills of their hand who knew these common arts, were very valued within a community. And then as industry progressed, people began to outsource. You see a big jump of this after World War II and the GI Bill. Now everybody gets to go to college. Right, and all of a sudden, people who work with their hands are looked down upon all the more, because oh, you don't know anything, right? Hey, yes, you do, actually. In fact, I know some stuff. Hey, that's that shirt I made you're wearing. What are you eating for dinner? When I was a kid, my mother had a sewing machine like this. It was my grandmother's, and I can remember vividly when I was about 7 years old, she would let me help her lay out the patterns on the table. And I would help pin it, and I would go around and cut the little triangles where the hems would go. Right? Anyone who's ever worked with patterns knows what I'm talking about right there. Right? She was apprenticing me to tailoring when I was about 7, 8 years old. Right? Now, she never let me touch the pinking shears or do anything with the larger scale stuff because she was going to have to wear that to work. She made all her own clothes, my mother did. And it was partly just because of the nature of how we lived. We never wanted for anything, but she wanted for something that balanced out her executive life. She was a vice president of a hospital, worked her way up through management there for 35 years. She was pretty heavy on this. On the weekend, she would come home and can and make clothes because it was the perfect counterpoint to dealing with what she had to deal with all week. Total stress relief, right? And it was really cool as a kid to get in there and do it, which makes me look at this very differently. This is a sweatshop in China, and this is what happens when you industrialize the production of clothes, tailoring. Okay. This is what happens when you industrialize your food. And as a farmer who keeps chickens, I look at this in a very particular way. Right? Would you want your kids to learn science of this? This is called business agriculture. Or would you want them to learn how to keep a small flock of chickens? Which would be a little bit more serving. Okay. So now we come down to some things I've actually done that I can show you. Here's the evidence for what I'm talking about. Okay, two programs that we've actually implemented at our school across the last couple of years, Cooking STEM and something called the Ancient Technology Project. The way that we've taken our essentially focus on the common arts and woven them into our science strands. So the foundations for this Cooking STEM, this occurs in Science 5. This is the program that my son just went through this last year, my oldest. And the foundations for this are what they're learning in Math 5, right? The basics of proportion, rates, fractions, decimals, conversions, those kind of things. And we're on Math and Focus, by the way. If any of you guys want to talk about that later, we can do that. And also this gardening strand that's kind of worked the way through the school. Every school or every class in my school gardens. The younger ones have a box about 8 foot by 4 foot out in the courtyard where they eat lunch that they're supposed to tend. But the fifth graders have a field. There was an Eagle Scout who was looking to come and do a project for us last year, and I said, buddy, I want you to make a field. Go out there with this tiller, get your guys together, fence the thing in. That's going to be our new garden space. Because what we want to do is grow food from heirloom seed, take care of it along the way, and then harvest and prepare it with our own hands. Seed to table. Plus the storage, right? You're not buying from Burpee every year. You've got the seeds from last year. You learn how to do that, too. And so we train them not only in the gardening and the chem, physics, and bio that goes to that, but also in cooking, because cooking involves a lot of chem, physics, and bio. You modify molecules by heating them up or cooling them down, right? And that changes tastes because we receive those molecules in certain electrical impulses along the nerve pathways of the tongue. You see where this can go, right? Look at all the integration that's already happening. And we're sitting at table using our manners, most of us. So here's what it looks like. This is a crew that's headed out to the field space to plant the seedlings that they've germinated and lovingly tended for about 3 weeks in the classroom. And you can see them down there at the foot of Miss Dupre here at the other side. We have squashes and tomato plants, and we have herbs. We have oreganos, and we have what do we have in there? I think we have some dill in there that ended up going around. And these guys have used their mathematical skill to lay out boxes on the ground, right, planting beds with right-angle corners of certain dimensions. They were given the task, go apply your mathematics, and all you have is a string. And so they had to figure out how they were going to do these measurements, just a string. What you figure out eventually is that you can make knots along the string that measure this. And the ancient Egyptians had figured out you can make a perfect. If you take 3 knots and then 4 knots, the hypotenuse makes 5 knots, and this last corner is a perfect right triangle. That's how they laid out the pyramids. And the kids kind of figure this out by a little bit of hints as you go along. You never show them. Let them struggle with it and then mess with it for a good 40 minutes. But that's 40 minutes of uninterrupted problem solving. I could give them a whole bunch of worksheets and say, hey, do these for 40 minutes. Or I could give you a problem and make you go at it. Think about your homework that way, by the way, guys. Like what you can accomplish with that. So these guys take these plants that they've lovingly grown and place them in garden beds that they lovingly tend. You can see those down there at the bottom side. And they come out there every week and weed them. And they have rotations for watering them. And even now during the summer, the kids are coming back at intervals. They've signed up. We have an online document for this. They can come back and harvest. You want to come get some food? Come get it. There's plenty. Oh, but when you're there, you got to weed and you got to water. Okay? And that's part of your stewardship. You're getting virtue through this. And then they get to take these plants inside and cook with them. Okay, we have a group right here that's actually producing different kinds of sauces and salads. Right, we just grew these salads right out there. And, of course, they're measuring and they're cutting. They're using all the tools that cooks would. And if I stop these girls and ask them, you know, tell me a little bit about the biology of the lettuce. They can tell you about seeds and cotyledons and the original leaves that come up and the nutrients that lettuce needs in the soil and can it grow in the shade or in the full sunlight. What kind of moisture does it need? These guys have learned the science of growing things, what it takes to tend them. And these little fellas have become very proud of their spaghetti sauce. This was a special recipe that they concocted, knowing a little bit about onions and garlic. And they're all like lovers of the strong taste right there. So after all this, we go down to the cafeteria. We put tablecloths down. We set the table. We sit at the table. We wait for everyone to be there. We say grace, and we eat our meal. We break bread together. Very unscientific, but just right. Ancient technology project is something that's a little bit more involved, right? And this is my set. This is my classroom. When I was hired as the academic dean, part of that was to kind of rewrite the way that we were doing things, and I had to make my own classroom the model for what I want others to see. And so my first thing out the door was to do this. The foundations for the Ancient Technology Project are History 6, in which they're studying ancient Greece and ancient Rome, and Science 6. We go through a basic history of science and philosophy of science unit at the beginning of the year called Framing Science, where we walk through how science has changed, the paradigm of science has changed through history. We do awesome architecture, which I just described a moment ago, physical forces, molecular motion, solid liquid gases, all those good pieces. And eventually the Greece and Rome unit and the Awesome Architecture unit finish up at about the same time, and this is totally planned. I sync this up with a history teacher every year for good reason. Because there comes a day, inevitably, where in class, and gosh, hey, how do you guys like a history unit? Wasn't that funny? Wow, all the things you learned. Tell me something you learned. And we go around the table and kind of pick it up. Gosh, wouldn't it be cool if we could take what we do in here and, like, rebuild something that they had back then? Wouldn't that be awesome? Let's do it. And there's, you know, they know this is coming now, but the first year I did that, it was like stunned silence. What do you mean? Where are we going with this? All right. And across the next 16 to 18 weeks, it's the longest project they've ever engaged in their entire school lives up to this point, we literally go from research, R&D, design, prototyping and failing, gathering, all the way to a final artifact that they craft for their own hands using authentic ancient materials. No plastic, nothing the ancients wouldn't have had, leather, metal, wood. And we try to use, as many cases as we can, the authentic tools they would have used back then, too. I do keep power tools on hand. Some of them I let the kids use if they've proven responsible. Others I do not. But what we do in the end is produce. So let me show you what this looks like in pictures. Here's the research phase. Everybody picks what they generally want to do and who they might want to work with on this project. And, of course, that's subject to lots of interpretation, as you may imagine, sixth graders. But literally, the field is as wide as, well, what are you interested in? This last year, I had somebody build an ancient Greek wind organ from scratch. We did fishing tackle. I taught a couple kids how to flint knap, and we made stone tools right there in the classroom. A couple kids made suits of armor. I had three girls make a chainmail gladiator arm. If you want to keep girls in science, make gladiator arms. Seriously, it's the best one. We had some architecture projects, and we actually had some little girl go back and recreate a portion of the frieze in the Parthenon using nothing but etching tools and poured plaster of Paris. Right, that was her art tool. And the whole idea was to explore the concept of stone. So as they're researching, they're gathering as much information as they can, and I have to front load this. I work with the librarian to show them what URLs are good to go to, trusted.edu and a K-12, watch the comms, watch the orgs. We can talk about all the natures of modern research, but you've got to dig into the books, too. I want you to start with the books. Don't race to your friend Wikipedia, and don't race to YouTube to find a video of someone doing this. I want you to look it up with a book first. And I have a library I've accumulated across the last 5 years, about two shelves wide, on basic techniques, historical technologies, and we literally go from there and eventually bridge our way into the things that are not in the library. I think about computers as tools to bridge to what's not in your paper. Okay, if you don't have that paper on hand, then go look it up. We'll go from there. These guys are planning. You might not be able to see it, but this fellow down here, yeah, you can actually. That is a Greek oxybelles. He went back and looked at Alexander the Great's army and what made his artillery so good, and he realized that they had this bow that was based on the gastrophades, this belly bow, where they had a stick that came out of the front, and the bow was there, and you kind of pulled it back and shot it off your belly, right? And that was what they did. But Alexander's army figured that if they built a wooden stand and mounted one of these on there and got a hand crank on it that used a mechanical advantage, you could really shoot stuff really far. And, of course, that's exactly what they wanted to do. And so we said, sure, no problem. We can. And I'm looking at it, in my mind, knowing what I know about woodworking, we can build that out of dimensional lumber. I can go to Lowe's, and I can get all the lumber you need for that. And for the pieces I can't get, I can bring you a tree. And you're going to learn how to carve that down. And so that's what they're doing. They're mapping it out with that thing on the table going, how long should it be? And they're creating a detailed schematic. The guys on this side of the table, in addition to helping with that, are making a materials list. What are we going to need? And then I send them to Lowe's.com and have them look up how much that's going to cost. Right? You've got to be a cost-effective engineer here. So you got your calculations going on, and they've got to multiply. They've got to obviously do some addition. And they are given certain parameters. You know, you can't exceed certain amount of funding unless you can come up with the materials yourself. Can you do it? And so they have to be resourceful, which is another good virtue. This little girl had never used a power drill before in her life. Those of you who have used power drills can probably tell that by looking at the way she's holding it, right? It will not blow up. It's okay. It does not shoot sparks. However, it's going to torque your wrist if you hold it like that, and her friend there is waiting for her turn to do the same thing, right? The first thing that I do with them as their research phase kind of winds down is take them through tool safety. This is how you use tool X. This is a hammer. This is a screwdriver. This is a chisel, and literally you have to start there. Right, they know what a hammer looks like because of Donkey Kong, but they don't know necessarily how to operate a drill like this. How does it go forward and backwards? Well, there's this little button, and you can switch. And run out of power? Okay, so you got to be in charge of putting the battery back to make sure that the next people who come along can use this too. About a week and a half of my time is dedicated towards burning in the skills of safety and essentially identifying how to use and use tools in a safe manner. These girls are measuring out what was going to become a Germanic shield. Right, they got very fascinated by the Romans' conflicts with the Germanic tribes, and they wanted to make a Germanic shield. The end result of this was actually a very nice flat shield with a hammered boss. I gave them a sheet of brass, and they used a planishing hammer to make that nice round dome shape that goes in the middle. They tapped it out and put brass rivets in it that they made. They made the rivets using a little bit of a blowtorch and, again, sheet brass. Totally within their purview. They were capable of doing it. And they're also capable of telling you that you've got to heat things up to make them a little liquid to bend and make it malleable, that wood is made of cellulose fibers, and therefore you can't use the same tools on it as you can microcrystalline metal. Think about how all that is kind of playing through the heads now, right? I've got to think about my materials, and I've got to think about which tools I need to use in order to make it go. This little girl was learning how to use the Dremel cutoff tool. You can see the sparks. They love this. And there's a day in my class when I always have my cell phone out as I'm teaching this stuff. I take a picture of each one of them doing this and mail it right to their parents. This is what your kid was doing in class today. Just thought you might, because this is, you're going to hear about this in the backseat of the car. Right? This is going to be one of the cool things. And you notice the safety procedures, right? She does not have her hair back, but normally I would have them put their hair, you know, back in a ponytail like they're supposed to. This girl running the drill press does. Right? And this girl had never done something like this before in her whole life. And she became an expert drill press user. Right? And this was one that she was actually making a piece of a firing block for a catapult right there. That was her chosen project. And I'll show you that catapult in just a minute. Prototyping. Don't go right to the materials. A sheet of leather costs a lot of money. So you're going to make it in tag board first and make all your mistakes there, because I can give you a new piece of paper, but it's hard for me to give you a new sheet of leather. Okay, stewardship of materials. And understanding what things actually cost crashes right in the face of disposability. Well, before, I've always, whenever I need a pencil, there's one. It just shows up. No, it's not going to be like that with your leather. You get one shot at this. And that means you got to measure twice and cut once, and make all your mistakes on this paper. I love these paper armors because every one of them invariably looks like Edward Scissorhands just went to town on the thing. There are cut marks all over. And one of the last things I say is, okay, go back and fix that. Because when you take that and trace it on the leather, it's got to be smooth. Well, how do I do that? Use tape. Maybe even in some cases remake a part. Because it's a prototype. It's meant to be bent and mixed. And these guys went from there. These guys are making scale mail. You can see the leather cutout right there. That is their actual harness. And they're making rows of scales that they're going to line up like Lorica squamata, right? That lizard skin Roman armor that officers wore. And it took them, you can see a model that I had for them from a kid who made one 2 years ago in the background. They're using that as a consulting piece. And so as I get these artifacts accumulating in there that have been made in authentic ways, I keep them as a museum. And I put the kids' names under there and what it is, and now I've got 4 years' worth of art in my room as well. And when they need to consult something, I don't have to send them to a book anymore. Sometimes I can say, well, go look at that and tell me what you see. These little girls made the chainmail gladiator arm. I taught them how to knit chainmail. It takes about 2 minutes to learn, and it takes forever to do. It's a patience game. And I say, if you guys want to make chainmail, that's awesome. How patient are you? Have you ever knitted something before? Because that's what you're about to do, and if you don't know what you're getting into, you might not like it. All right, consider it. These girls loved it. And in fact, their parents would call me and say, we went on a road trip to such and such a beach, and all they did was sit in the back of the seat and make mail, you know, in the back of the back seat of the car. I love that. That's great. Here's from prototype to layout to finished product. And that was the course of a week and a half. These girls took their paper model, tuned it up, cut out all the pieces from leather, drilled them, tapped them out, figured out where the rivets needed to go, and here's one of the final assemblies. And they're making a leather Roman lorica, right? Something that, infantry armor. Right? This little girl was the one who did the frieze of the Parthenon. First, we had to figure out how to make stone because we didn't have the right kind of stone available. Well, how do we do that? Well, maybe we could pour it. You know, concrete's kind of like stone. Yeah, but concrete's going to be a little too grainy for it. Go look at what it is. We'll figure this out. And across the next couple of days, we came up with the idea that plaster of Paris was just right. It'll pour. It has a similar consistency to the kind of stone you'd be working on. You can do some of the work with Dremel engraving tools, only because that gives you that extra power, that extra oomph to make depth and texture. But she actually opted for hand tools on most of this project. And you can't maybe necessarily see the finished thing. She went back and figured out what the Greeks would have used to color this on the Parthenon, because today we only see the background. We don't see what they colored. And she got those pigments, two of them she made from scratch, and then she painted this. So this is where she was going with it. Here was that catapult, by the way, which was able to fire a bolt 4 feet long further than the football field at the upper school. Right, and sixth graders did this who have never touched tools before in their lives. They'd never used a hammer, never used a drill, never used screwdrivers. And in the course of 16 weeks, they were able to produce this. Now, invariably, the question comes back. People say, well, where's the science in this? Along the way, they've done everything that the STEM protocol would call for. They've done graphing. They've done data analysis. They've done multiple experiments. We're going to test this wood to see how much pressure it can take or strain it can take, stress, before it fails, because you have to know that when you're building these things. We've done simple machines and experiments with those. They're just walking through the method like living and breathing it. But they're doing it in such a way that they're understanding that God made these materials in a certain way. And all we're doing is surfing the awesomeness that he put in there. We are riding this wave of providence. We pray at the beginning of each of these classes for no accidents, no bloodshed, obviously. But we also give thanks for the materials we're using and the nature of stewardship. And that every day refreshes the narrative. Why are we here? This is what we're doing. This was a short list of those science. If I went and put the Virginia Standards for Science for sixth grade, the public schools used next to this, we would have exceeded it. But we're doing it in a context that is deep and rich, and something that is by far greater than the work of just the head, because it includes the heart and the hands. So I'm going to ask you guys to think just for a few moments about how you might be able to take something in the common arts and weave it in. Because if you're looking for hands-on, here's the template. And I'm going to encourage you guys one more thing. I'll do this before I take questions. Take a survey of who knows what in your building. Because it could be that the fourth grade teacher who has something that might really work well for woodworking doesn't know anything about woodworking, but your janitor might. So bring them in. Get the right people with the right kids over the right skills. And you will then share not only the narrative but the love and build that mentorship that comes along with all of those things. Some other options to pitch at you guys. Build a chicken coop with an attached run. That's one that we're trying now. I've got my fifth graders planning it out in math class because they have all the stuff they need. My sixth graders are building it. My first graders who study birds are populating it. They have to figure out which kind of breed of chicken we can get that won't scratch up everything in the run. It's Selkies. We already kind of know this. But if you don't know chickens, you won't know that. And they don't know chickens, so they don't know that. And they're going to have to go figure it out. Third grade does simple machines and solar power. And so we're giving them the task of building the solar power door to open in the morning and close at night. Because chickens do that. They need to go in. And we don't want to send someone back to school every day to go and open and close the door. We need this to be somewhat automatic. And so they have a task. Every class in the school has a task that will end up in this big project of the chicken coop. And there'll be a grand chickening ceremony somewhere along the line where we put the chickens in there. Probably next year's kindergarten will hatch those chickens. We'll order Selkie eggs, and they can do it all the way from scratch. Nature photography, it's hunting, but with biology and earth science, and nothing has to die. Right? The same things go along that route. You can take cameras out there, digital cameras. I got a grant a couple years ago for 25 digital cameras. It was one of the best things we introduced in the ecosystem of the school. Because not only can you put cameras in places where kids can take pictures of their events from their perspective, which is really amusing, but you can also send people out there to do nature observation and bring it back in. We keep a record of what we saw. Can you tell your way around and the time by the sun, moon, and stars as portions of your astronomy unit? We teach them about the planets, but do we teach them how things align that give us watches and calendars and clocks? Think about how that goes. Also, orienteering. We're surfing the magnetic field this year in our PE class. We're going to build a course for them to go out and orienteering with compasses, check it out and run it. Growing cotton, picking it, carding it, spinning it, and turning it into cloth. That was one. We have some kids in third grade studying Virginia history. I've grown tobacco plants at school and cotton plants. And we're doing both of those. When the tobacco gets ripe, we're cutting it and hanging it in the room to see how long it takes to dry. Right? We're now a tobacco barn, right? But we also show them what goes into making linen, because if you've never worked with cotton before, that's a ton of labor. It makes you appreciate your shirt, and also the value of synthetic fibers, where all you do is pour a batch of oil in there and draw it out. You can't do that with cotton. It's very organic. Okay, so what else might you use? I'm going to kind of rewind this one to this screen at this point and do two things. The first is to thank you for being here. The fact that you are here tells me that you guys are just as hungry for this hands-on stuff as I am. And honestly, we are in the front end of this conversation. We are reclaiming classical Christian education from where it hasn't been before. So you guys are on the front of the wave, right? When you start working this stuff, I want to hear about it because I'm a practitioner just like you. We come up with a nice compost of ideas. We're going to continue to grow. And, of course, the last thing I want to close with is any questions you may have. As you take a look at this, and why don't we do this? Let's think, pair, share it. Turn to the people around you and talk about the questions you've got. Warm up the pump for a moment, and I'll pull you back together up here in 2 minutes to take any of those questions that you may have. Go. One minute. All right, as you wrap it up, it is now 10:53. We're exactly an hour out from where we started. If you'd like to stick around and talk for a bit, next session doesn't start for a couple minutes. Take your questions. What do you have? Yes, sir.
The school that I'm at, we're operating out of the church.
Yes.
So, facilities-wise, we don't have the opportunity to do the outdoor gardening.
Yeah.
Have you ever worked with or know anybody that's done anything with hydroponics?
Yes. Yes. Hydroponics is it's an easy way to save space. I might encourage you to do this. If you can't do anything with gardening, you can still do something called skills of the tracker. And you saw this in the last one where you get outside and you're tracking things. That's one that you can do even out of a church basement. Let's talk hydroponics in a bit. Any others? Yes, ma'am. No. Obviously, what we do is we take that down to the chem lab after I'm done with that, and I let the kids analyze it. And we do the old smoking demonstration where I burn it in a tube and blow it through a filter and say, this is why you don't smoke, right? It's an easy way to go. But we also take a look at chemicals. We isolate chemicals out of those leaves just for fun so that they can see what's actually in them. And again, the big narrative on that one is you got to understand a plant as a whole, right? One of the things that we do with plants in the modern world is draw out certain chemicals that we want, right? All of us had coffee this morning. We understand how this goes. But plants are these wonderful kind of like tapestries of chemicals too. It's not just that one chemical that makes up the plant. There are other things in it. So bigger lessons on chem. Yes, ma'am.
We are a fairly new school, and we do share with church buildings.
Bless you. Got it. One of the best things to do is to think outside the wallet. Who has a circular saw they're not using? Anybody got one of those laying around? When I was starting this program up, I had a donor who was willing to give us some money for it, but I went around to Goodwill and I found some good tools there. I went and found the local high school was closing down their shop program because they were making more room for other things that they wanted. And it was funny because they were actually ditching their hand tools to make a makerspace, which didn't make any sense to me, but I all of a sudden got a whole bunch of drills out of it. Just keep your eyes open for things. Put out want ads. School needs tools, etc. Take it from there. Yes, sir.
How does this feed into the secondary program?
Okay. We are working on that right now. In fact, a running conversation I've had while I've been at this conference is with my upper school head about how to do this slowly and gradually through 7 and 8, because those kids come out of my classroom kind of primed with this, and then we're looking at it in the upper grades. One of the ideas that's crossed the table is, what do we do with our physics program? Because that seems to be one that is the easiest to do this kind of stuff with. And what we're talking about there is maybe actually building computers, working with electronics, working with materials that are a little bit more man-made, but understanding the physics of those materials in the process of doing it. It's kind of like working with wood, but instead you're working with those. Other examples have been actually getting those kids to make lab apparatus for everyone else, right? Get some bar stock and let them learn how to cut and make precision instruments they can use for, a setup for pendulums, a setup for ramps, and other things that will pay it forward in the program. We're actually building to improve what we do here and saving ourselves a lot of money in the process. So that's still very vestigial. If you find answers to that, I will sit out in the audience next year and you can tell me. Thank you. There's a question over here I heard just a moment ago. Yes, ma'am. Okay. Makerspace is a movement that's going on right now. The making movement is what it is. And a lot of it has to do with getting kids to craft. But there's, if you look at most schools that do makerspaces, they do with 3D printers. And they say, our kids are crafting, and they're building with things. But in what they're really doing is telling a computer what to do, and they're assembling. It's a very different thing to print a chess piece than to carve it from wood. And so notice the narrative difference right there. Look up the Makers Movement and see what you think of that. All right, guys, I don't want to make you late for your next session. Thank you all for being here. God bless you.